Usually when we think of Israel, we focus instinctively on that country's relationships with others. Israel's cold peace with Egypt and Jordan, for instance, or its invasions of Lebanon and Gaza, or its relationships with Palestinians. But Israeli journalist Ari Shavit turns the lens inward in a kind of a psychological portrait of his own country in a book called My Promised Land. Shavit's Israel is riven with different tribes. All of them have a point. All of them also have huge blind spots. And that's the tension in which they forge the state that the rest of us see encountering the world in ways that are both wonderful and sometimes troubling. Welcome to this installment of the Lionel Gelber Prize podcasts. We're having conversations with five authors who are shortlisted for the 2015 Lionel Gelber Prize for Best Book in International Affairs. The prize is sponsored by the Lionel Gelber Foundation, the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto, and Foreign Policy Magazine. My name is Rob Steiner. Ari Shavit is a well-known Israeli journalist who now serves on the editorial board of Haaretz and used to be chair of the Association of Civil Rights in Israel. My Promised Land, his latest book, is published by Scribe. Ari makes the point that he's a Jerusalemite in exile in Tel Aviv, but today he's joining me in farther exile from Boston. Welcome, Ari.
Pleasure to be with you.
So the book is, I found it to be really a masterful kind of deconstruction of so many different myths that inform Israeli identity. Almost everyone one could imagine, left myths, right myths, secular myths, religious myths. Every country has its myths, of course, but I came away from this book almost feeling that there were too many myths in Israel, and that, you know, no wonder no one can figure out how to make peace with the country, because the first thing that you encounter is a country that it doesn't even have a clear idea of what itself is.
One of the reasons I wrote the book, I had a personal reason, which is a personal need to decipher the Israel story for myself. Ever since I remember myself, I had the notion that I was born in a unique land, into a unique historical happening, a unique nation. And I had the need to understand what the hell is going on. What is this all about? But the other reason to write the book was my feeling that almost everybody lost the Israel narrative. So first of all, Israelis lost the narrative with some interesting reasons. I think a lot has to do with the debate over the occupation and peace, but this is not the only reason. We began as a nation, as a people, with a very strong sense of meaning, with a very strong, powerful narrative. And sadly, as we grew stronger politically, economically, militarily, the narrative disintegrated. But I also think that many people who talk about Israel, whether they love Israel and hate Israel, lost the narrative. And there are some good reasons. Because you're so preoccupied with the details, with the ongoing happenings, with the news, the conflict, the war, sometimes the peace process, I think many people, again, whether they're pro or anti-Israel, have lost sight over the overview, the larger picture. And what I tried to do, actually, in this book is to do two things that are different but are combined. One is to give the larger picture, to put the context back, and in a sense to see that Israel is a remarkable human endeavor, for better and for worse. I'm not into whitewashing on the one hand, and I describe disturbing elements of our history and our present. On the other hand, I think one has to look at the remarkable man-made wonder or miracle that Israel is. Israel is an extraordinary human enterprise of people who faced extinction and in many ways saved themselves in the very last moment, building a home for the homeless nation. The other thing I tried to do is to bring the human dimension back. This is a book that has history in it. It's about history, but it's not a history book, definitely not an academic history book. It's relevant to politics, but it's not a political book. I thought there's far too much polemics regarding Israel. People fight over it all the time. I tried to do something else, which is to look at the human stories of the humans who made Israel. And through their different human stories, bring, in a sense, back the biography of a nation, which is such a fascinating nation. Again, whether you like it or not, and whether you're pro or against, it's an extraordinary story. And I thought that bringing it back to the human level is so essential. So In this sense, you're right that I think I challenge many dogmas in this book, right, left, and center, religious, secular. And yet, at the same time, I would actually argue that I'm trying to bring back the sense of wonder, but in a different way, because too many people treat Israelis as if they are either demons or angels. My claim is that we are no angels. We are definitely not demons. We are humans. We are humans with a remarkable human history, human story. And that's the story I tried to tell.
So you're talking about this. It's interesting because I hadn't read this as a kind of a restorative project of going back to a narrative. Was there ever a narrative? Because my sense, even from reading your book, is that depending on who arrived when, for what reasons, we're talking about Jews who came to Israel or Jews who'd been there for, even before that, but whoever arrived when, for whatever reason, each came with his or her own narrative. Was there actually a narrative that you're really harking back to?
I think there was. Of course, there are always differences in any immigrant's country. Canada, United States, every immigrant's society has, the different shades and nuances of different versions of the collective story. But I think the Jews, my people, the Jewish people, had a very strong narrative once we got started with this great project. And the basic narrative was that we are the just and the besieged. That was the feeling up until 1967. And most people in Israel, of course, Palestinians, Arabs, and many others did not subscribe to that one. But within Israel, that was a very strong narrative. And again, one has to remember that although Israel is so criticized these days, and although a lot of the criticisms are justified, and I have a lot of criticisms of policy of my government, I oppose occupation and settlement, and yet I think that what one forgets, many people lost sight of the fact that the Jewish people, the Jews, were the ultimate other of Europe for 1,500 years. And we were about to become Europe's ultimate victim. And we had to save ourselves. We actually literally had to save ourselves. In this sense, Israel is a life-saving project. Israel's main sin is that it was established too late. If Israel would have been established in 1920s rather than 1948, millions would have been saved. So the need to have a home for the homeless people was there. I think the need is still there. But that gave a very strong sense of meaning and a shared narrative. We felt that after a long, long journey, a lot of persecution throughout the millennium, wandering, being persecuted, living in disgrace, being hated, at long last, we build our home.
But I want to make sure
if I may. That changed after 67, and then I would say the seventh day of the Six-Day War changed that, and every year that has passed since made the cracks in this narrative deeper. I still think that the essential feeling is justified, but of course, once we got bogged down to occupation, to the issues of the West Bank and Gaza, with the repeating wars, with the use of force, I can understand why many people have lost touch with the fundamental understanding of the Israeli condition. But the Israeli condition is quite extraordinary because we are faced with this unique challenge that we ran for our lives, escaping Europe before it was about to slaughter us. And then we found ourselves building our home under a volcano with this deep, terrible, tragic conflict with the Palestinians, based on the fact that we did not see them and they did not see us. And this mutual blindness, Israelis would not see the Palestinians, Palestinians would not see the Israelis, that led to a 100-year war that is so, so horrible, full of tragedy, torment, suffering, both for Israelis and for Palestinians. So I think that what I tried again to do in the book is, on the one hand, to remind people of the remarkable story. I think there is a truly heroic element to it. And on the other hand, to describe in detail and with pain the terrible tragedy. And it's the subtitle of the book is The Triumph and the Tragedy of Israel. The triumph is the triumph of the human spirit, of the ultimate survivors who created the life for themselves and chose life and created a place that is full of life and celebrates life. The tragedy is this horrible, horrible, horrible conflict that is so persistent that would not stop. You know, Ireland is basically resolved. The Balkans are pretty much okay.
Mm-hmm.
This conflict is so persistent, stubborn, because it's based on this mutual blindness that made these two people who should share a land be so cruel to each other.
Now, I want to make sure that people don't come away, people who haven't read this book, don't come away with the sense that this is some kind of, you know, that the project here is to, you know, simply restore the original rationale for Israel and ignore the rest. Because actually there's some really complex stuff going on in here. I mean, you're, the way that you're breaking this apart, you're sort of, I was struck by how deeply you're able to critique each different component of Israeli society that you're talking about. Each one of them, including ones that I would not have expected, knowing a little bit about your history, ones that I would not have expected you to show a great deal of empathy for, you show great empathy for, and you critique them, and others with which I would have expected you to have some history with and some empathy for, you show some empathy for, and you critique them just as much. And sort of we walk away with a question almost of, you know, what do I do with this? Everyone is right and everyone is wrong. What are you actually supposed to do with that?
Great question. First of all, you know, that's me. I mean, I throughout my life, I refuse to be part of a herd. I think we have much too much intellectual totalitarianism in our life, much too much tribalism in intellectual and academic life. And throughout my life, I refuse to participate. So although I have very strong opinions, and I definitely can be identified as part of the Israeli left, center left, whatever you want to call it. But I never felt that that means I should not criticize my own political tribe or see the flaws of people whom I admire or support. So I do not think that we should all act like the communist parties acted during Stalin. And sometimes I see many scholars and many intellectuals and many journalists obeying these party lines, so to speak. You know, each op-ed I write for my paper, I look at the reality around me, I think about it, and I come to my own conclusion. I don't take marching orders from anyone.
There's a great...
And I think that's the role of a writer. I think that's the role of journalists. I think that's the role of intellectuals. I'm sad to say that there isn't enough of that. There is too much conformist... unified kind of thinking among people who are supposed to promote free thinking and free speech. This phenomena is more striking actually in more open-minded and liberal circles than in the conservative circles, because you know with people who are committed to nationalism, you expect that. But sometimes people on the other side, you are surprised by the difficulty to address inconvenient truths. Throughout my life, I felt a commitment to deal with complexity. That means to deal also with inconvenient truth, and not the other people's inconvenient truth. The inconvenient truths of myself,
of your own,
my people, my tribe. So I did that in the book as well. What do you come out of this? I'll tell you one thing. I did not try to promote my own political agenda in the book. I'm a very opinionated person. I have my own strong ideas. I express them in my writing as a journalist and television. In Haaretz, in some American publications, I do that all the time. What I did here is to try to tell the general story, to listen to all different kinds of people, even including the ones I really, 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 whose positions I really reject. But I didn't try to crucify them. I thought my role was to listen, to bring their voices, and to let the reader make his decision. The one wish I have, and that's, I think, an important one, is I ask people to address complexity. I think that Israel is such a complex phenomenon. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is so complex. The Middle East is so complex that anyone who has a simple, simplistic idea or attitude to it is wrong by definition. So I ask people to wrestle with the complexity. I believe that if we will all force ourselves, demand of ourselves, to wrestle with the complexity, we can have a much more civilized and much more intelligent discussion regarding all these sensitive issues. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, we'll discover that we agree on more than we thought. Mm-hmm. But if we do not, the disagreements will be much more thoughtful, deep, than they are right now. I think that the kind of simplistic, dogmatic polarization is flawed. And again, in my writing and in my book, I try to bring another option.
One of the things you just said about, you know, how every time when you begin writing a column for Haaretz, you look at the actual situation around you, reminds me so powerfully of a line from the theologian Abraham Heschel, who wrote about prophets and prophecy and came up with an insight that I think should apply equally to journalism. It was that the work of prophecy is the sheer seeing of what we face. And yet those prophets who did that were incredibly lonely people. Some of them on the verge of suicide. I'm going to ask you about that, but it must be pretty lonely to be in a politicized environment.
I'm not into describing myself as a prophet, but I do agree that I think it's an essential. First of all, there is loneliness. I think part of being a decent, deep journalist and trying to be a profound writer is to be true to yourself and not to belong in this sense, not to go with the masses, to be willing to go against the wind. Again, sometimes the wind that's your friends and your family and your peers. You know, that's the difficult part. And I'll say the following. You know, I will make many mistakes, but I make all my mistakes on my own. I don't obey any Politburo, whether the Politburo of conservatism or the Politburo of liberalism. I won't take the party line of the nationalist. I won't take the party line of the peacemaker. I look at reality, at a very complex reality. I try to figure it out. I try to be rational, to think about it. And I try to be humane. I try to have empathy, not only to my friends and fellow countrymen, but to my so-called enemies. I try to look at reality from everybody's point of view, as much as I can do, in order to have a complex and rich understanding as much as I can. And then if at the end of the process I make a mistake, the mistake is mine. Mm. The mistake is not that I was a kind of soldier of some sort of doctrine, whether a benign doctrine or a vile doctrine. I am not there, and my life's work is to be a free spirit, a free agent, an individual.
There's one group in this book that seems to nonetheless get more, I don't know if it's sympathy or just excitement from you than any other. And it was not what I would expect. And it was the sort of gay party scene of Tel Aviv, which just seemed to be right for some reason. I don't mean politically right, but right, correct, onto some kind of deeper truth. I was really struck by your long description of them and what that seemed to mean for Israel.
Well, I'm not sure that it's only the gays. It's true that I think that my chapter about the Tel Aviv nightlife, partying Tel Aviv, in which the gays are definitely dominant and are in many ways leaders within that world, but it's not only the gays.
No.
And I think you're onto something. I'll slightly beg to differ. I think that on the one hand, I do believe that there is something, and when I describe this night, I say, you know, parties in Israel are so intense, and there is something to them that parties, intense parties, in London clubs and Paris clubs, and perhaps even Toronto clubs or Ibiza clubs, don't have, because there is a sense of rebelling against an impossible reality. I think that the young people who go wild in such a magnificent, lively, sexy, sensual way in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, they're not just partying. They're not just partying because they have a history. Their grandparents or great-grandparents are either refugees from the Arab world or Holocaust survivors. Their parents or grandparents fought in war after war to build this nation and sustain it. many of them have to go the next morning to fight. All of them are exposed to danger that young people in other democracies are not exposed to anymore. So there is something unique about the Israeli condition, not because we are great people or because we are terrible people, but because we have a different kind of biography that put us in a very unique position. And basically the position is that Tel Aviv is very much an Amsterdam that is not too far from occupied Gaza and not too far from the atrocities of Damascus. So having an Amsterdam in this violent, tribal, fanatic Middle East, having an Amsterdam when you have the issue of the Palestinian conflict, having an Amsterdam when you might go be called to war tomorrow morning, having an Amsterdam when you do not know what's the future of your state, whether your country, your nation will be there in 20 years' time or 50 years' time, that gives the Tel Aviv-Amsterdam element an element that even wonderful Amsterdam doesn't have. So I think you are saying something profound in the fact that I tried to capture the spirit that it's not just hedonism. Actually, the hedonistic fit that we are, look, Israelis tend to be extreme with whatever they do. When they fight with intensity, but when they celebrate and when they party and when they eat and when they get into gourmet food or they get into fine wine, they do it all the way. We tend to be very total. We are very intense and very total. So the party scene in Tel Aviv is really remarkable in the sense that it's, in a sense, it's a party on the edge. We live on the edge in Israel. And yet we've decided not to live with fear and bitterness, not just whine and cry about how difficult our life is. In many ways, the nice thing, the impressive thing about Israel is that it does have a free, robust, free society. It does have this amazing innovation and creativity and sensuality and sexuality, which is deeply a choice of life. Because Israelis have a terrible, terrible history of death. We are people that lost a third of its people not so long ago. We are threatened by death. But Israel is all pro-life in the hedonistic sense, not in the abortion sense. And in many ways, it's a celebration of life. So sometimes, because of that, it's too loud. It's too neurotic. It's too much. Sometimes, because of this, we become escapists and we don't see the problem and we're not enough aware of Palestinian suffering or Israeli suffering. But there is something quite deep about this wild Tel Aviv party, which has in it a sort of a kind of statement, a deep statement about the unique Israeli condition.
So let me ask just a last question here. Let's imagine a couple of months from now, if there's a new prime minister in Israel, she invites you or he invites you to the residence for a dinner specifically because you are not a politician and you do not follow anyone's Politburo, and asks you to teach her or him something about the country that they don't already understand. What do you tell them?
I would remind them the historical context. I would say to them that the wisdom and the greatness of young Israel was that we realized that being Jews, we must combine realism with morality. The old wisdom we had was knowing that we live in a rough, cruel world. We have to be strong. We cannot be powerless as well. Again, as we were in the past, we tried being powerless and it ended up with a horrific consequence. But at the same time, we must have morality and justice as part of our DNA and part of our life. The sad thing that happened in Israeli politics in the last 20, 30 years, it's not a question of this prime minister or another, is that the ongoing conflict made us more narrow-minded, we are not generous enough. We don't have enough empathy. And I think that if we bring back this sense of, again, the need to be strong, to defend ourselves, need to be realistic, to see the dangers around us, but at the same time, to bring back morality, to bring back a kind of mission. No, the history of our people is the history of a universal tribe. We were always a tribe. We always had a universal mission. I think we need to bring that message of having universal values, not only trying to have Israel be a kind of much more just society with much more social justice, much more respect for human rights and minority rights. I really want Israel to be a kind of oasis of liberty and freedom and real democracy. I think if we have the ingredients, again, Israeli individuals, I think, are there. Israeli society is very impressive, very rich, very free. Our politics are totally flawed. They've been flawed for decades. So if we bring back this sense of mission, this sense of morality, and combine it with this amazing energy that Israel has, I think we can make Israel again the benign Israel it was and it must be.
Hari Shavit, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
If you'd like to hear more podcasts in this series, we have conversations with more than 25 finalists for the Gelber Prizes over the past 3 years. You can find them all on iTunes by searching for Gelber Prize. That's G-E-L-B-E-R. Or you can find them on our website at www.monkschool.utoronto.ca/Gelber, G-E-L-B-E-R. I'm Rob Steiner, Director of the Monk School Fellowships in Global Journalism. Thank you for joining us.